Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and we're going to take a look at plant diseases today. At least that'll be our focus with our guest, Brian Hoddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. So we'll take a look at what diseases Brian's been seeing a lot of this year, and we'll talk about how to clean up diseased plants and, of course, answer all of your questions. Love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a garden photo or maybe a picture of a diseased plant, you can send it via email. Again, that's ideas@wpr.org. And Brian, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. Glad to be here again.
Well, we've recently been talking about doing less fall cleanup on the show, as a matter of fact, for winter interest and so forth. But are there some things that we really should be cleaning up in the garden in the fall?
Actually, lots of things this year, because in many areas of the state, it was really a great season for a lot of plant diseases. And most of those organisms that cause the problems survive in old plant debris that's died during the fall. And if you leave that there and allow it to stay there in the spring, you're just going to have a nice source of the pathogens to reinfect your plants next year. So if you don't want to do it in the fall because of the winter interest, make sure you do cleanup in the spring before the plants leaf out.
Okay. What were the main diseases this year?
Pretty much everything under the sun. Really depended upon where you were in the state, because we had some areas of the state that were relatively dry for much of the season. But here in the Madison area, we seemed to have rain pretty much every day, or at least it seemed that way. So we were seeing all kinds of fungal leaf diseases, bacterial diseases. There was actually a new pathogen I'd never seen. I knew of the pathogen from pictures I'd seen, and it was on my bucket list to see, called Crystallariella.
What the heck's that?
Well, it causes a zonate leaf spot, and it was very interesting. The county extension agent in Marathon County sent me some photos of some maple leaves, and when I saw the symptoms, I was pretty sure it was this particular fungus that was causing the problem, and I basically told her, send me a sample, I will do the diagnosis for free, because this is on my bucket list to see. And interestingly, the same day that sample came in, and it was this particular fungus, I also got a grape sample that came in, and I looked at it right after the maple, and I saw the same sort of reproductive structures on the grape, and I thought, did I cross-contaminate samples? But sure enough, the pathogen goes to both hosts, and so it was separate, the same disease on two different types of plants. So I was pretty psyched, and then we incubated the leaves in a moist chamber for a while, and this particular pathogen forms sclerotia, so the little tightly packed masses of fungal threads that are dark colored, and all these little spherical structures on the surface of the leaf. And I talked to our fruit pathologist in the department. She'd never seen this disease on grape before. So it was something new for her as well. So some unusual leaf diseases. We had a new disease enter the state on boxwood blight. I did not do the identification. That was caught through the lab at the Department of Agriculture, but that's a brand new disease on boxwood. Can be incredibly destructive and has caused serious problems on boxwood out east, and has been moving westward.
This way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they found it about 2 years ago in December in northern Illinois in the Chicago area, and we've just been waiting for it to get here, and it's here now.
What does it do?
It basically defoliates the shrubs and can basically kill them. It depends on the variety. Some varieties have some resistance, but the ones that tend to survive here in Wisconsin aren't particularly resistant. Then we've had, I deal with field crops as well, and we've had a relatively new disease called tar spot. Now, there's a tar spot that goes to trees.
To maples,
but it's a totally different organism, but it causes very similar symptoms on corn. And that one really got a foothold this year, and most of the counties in the bottom third of the state have fines of that particular disease. It's caused a fair amount of defoliation. And then we had a new bacterial disease that we found on corn this year. So that's a first report for Wisconsin, although that's been in the United States for a couple of years now. But we did the work on that in my lab.
Just out of interest, the tar spot in the corn, does that have any impact on, I can see how it affects yield of the corn, but does it affect those cattle or animals that ingest those?
As far as I'm aware, that's not a toxin producer, but we, because of the wet weather, we've also had a lot of grain rots. So the ears will actually rot, and some of those fungi do produce toxins. So there's an ear rot called gibberella ear rot. That particular fungus produces toxins that can cause problems if you feed the grain to animals. There are other ones as well that can cause issues. That's about the only one that I've seen, the gibberella ear rot, that's been, would be problematic in my mind.
So lots of new visitors to the state here.
Yeah, and a lot of old favorites as well. We've seen tar spot on maple, anthracnose, which are very common diseases on a variety of different woody ornamentals. We've also seen the tomato leaf blights, which everybody has problems with. We can certainly talk about those. I'm sure we'll have questions today about those. Powdery mildews have been relatively big. A lot of rust diseases, which are a group of fungal diseases that we see. I had white pine blister rust come in, which is an alternating rust. It actually needs two different hosts to complete its life cycle, and I had a client send in both hosts, so I was able to see pretty much all the stages at once.
Yeah, I was thinking back a few weeks ago, that came up on the show. Someone actually had that white pine blister rust attacking their pines.
Yeah, it's very distinctive both on pines and on the alternate host, which are ribes, so currants and gooseberries. On white pine, you get dead branches, and then in the spring it'll blister, so you get these kind of creamy white balloons that pop up through cracks in the bark, and those are filled with kind of creamy white spores. And then on gooseberries and currants, you get very rusty orange looking sporulation about mid-season.
Brian Huddleston, our guest today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison. Great to have him along, and certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say to him. So give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Again, you can email your photos and or questions to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Neil, who's in Northwest Green Bay. Hi, Neil.
Good morning. I was calling with a question related to what I think might be an oddity. I've got a yard that's covered in Creeping Charlie. Back in, I want to say June, when we were having a lot of rain, I noticed a sort of a ring-shaped, patch-shaped mildew, I'm guessing, or you can tell me otherwise. And it was essentially eating the Creeping Charlie out of the lawn, leaving the grass behind untouched.
Yeah, it would be hard to tell exactly what that might be without seeing a sample. Did you notice any sort of kind of whitish sort of sporulation on the leaves, or was it just that the leaves were turning brown and the plants were kind of dying back? Can you give me any additional information?
So what I want to say is, as the patch extended, the Creeping Charlie died from like a central location outward in a patch-like formation. There was this ring of black-brown material on the Creeping Charlie.
Okay.
And that just sort of died and then expanded gradually outward with that ring of black-brown or brown-black material.
I'm guessing it's fungal of some kind. Probably fungal. But again, I wouldn't know exactly which organism might be causing the problem without seeing a sample. The question is whether it actually killed the plant or not. It could very well be a foliar pathogen. Those typically don't kill the plants. They won't get into the crown and kill the entire crown and root system. So I would watch that patch and see whether or not the plants resprout and produce new vines and leaves next year, because it sounds like a great thing to try to get rid of Creeping Charlie.
That's what I was thinking.
On the other hand, my guess would be, unless it's something really serious, which you probably don't want in your yard, it's probably not lethal to the plant.
Interesting. Thanks, Neil, for calling. Yeah, if somebody could get their hands on a pathogen or whatever like that, that could...
Yeah, the issue is that most of the time with pathogens, they are not going to totally kill off everything. Yeah. And you end up oftentimes with resistant varieties of the of the plant. So you select for those individuals of the plant that aren't infected as much, so you get nice green plants later on. And that's very typical whenever we're breeding for resistance.
We'll go to Chris and Adams next. Hi, Chris.
Happy gloomy day.
Yeah, to you as well.
I have a cedar in my front yard, a mature cedar, and all of a sudden, all of the foliage on it is turning like bright pumpkin orange. And I'm wondering, since nothing eats cedar is what you put on your pets to keep the ticks and the fleas off, right? It's like nothing eats cedar. Could it just be from the rain? Is it just waterlogged?
Is this a white cedar, so soft needles rather than prickly needles?
Soft needles.
Yeah, so it's a white, sounds like a white cedar. And when you say orange, is it all of the needles on the
no,
shrub?
No, it's like some of the fronds, the whole frond is like orange.
Okay, and it's not just mainly the interior needles on the branches.
No.
It's all the way out to the tip of an individual branch.
To the tips of the individual branch.
But you still have some green on the shrub, is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, it's mostly green. It's just like one on each branch, there's like one frond that has turned pumpkin orange.
Yeah, it could be there are some fungal pathogens, again, that will go to white cedar. There's a little fungus called phyllosticha that we sometimes see causing those, particularly the end needles, to turn brown, or it could be orange as well. The other thing I would worry about a little bit, if you've had a lot of rain, is sometimes you can have issues with what are called canker diseases. So these are typically fungal as well. Those fungi actually infect the branches and then girdle them. And so anything from the point of infection out to the tip will die. And oftentimes on something like white cedar, it will turn orange. The reason I was asking so much about whether it was interior needles that were turning is that we do have a phenomenon at this time of the year called seasonal needle drop. And it occurs on conifers. We oftentimes see that on white cedar. And also, I had a sample of white pine come in this week where those older needles typically turn really bright yellow. And it's a normal needle loss at this time of the year. It's kind of like deciduous trees turning fall color, but it occurs primarily in white cedar and also white pine. Again, what I would suggest, if most of the shrub looks relatively good, I would go in and prune out those dead branches. And then make sure you disinfest your tools between cuts. So dip them for about 30 seconds in something like rubbing alcohol, something that's about 70% alcohol. You can also use 10% bleach if you want to, but that tends to corrode tools. Also, spray disinfectants are very good to use. You can just spray until the tool drips and then allow it to air dry. But I would be inclined to try to prune those out, because if it is one of these canker diseases, those fungi can grow down the branch into the main trunk. And if they girdle the main trunk, you basically lose the plant.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Chris. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Wendy in Green Bay. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, guys. My pug thinks you guys are in the house.
Oh.
Sorry about that. I have a peony that I got wilted in, and I am wondering if I put some black-eyed Susans in there, and they immediately had a white mildew that covered them from head to toe.
Okay.
Is there anything I can do? Should I be ripping that plant out?
Not necessarily. So you said you had peonies that were getting white powdery material, is that correct? And then the black-eyed Susan as well?
Well, the peony ended up with wilt last year.
Okay.
I've had it for like 10 years.
Okay.
No problem.
Okay.
It got wilt, so this year I put in some black-eyed Susans.
Okay.
And they got like a white mildew from head to toe where that peony was.
Had been. Okay.
Yeah. Did the leaves brown up afterwards, or did you just see kind of green leaves with whitish powder on the surface? And was it on the upper surface of the leaf or the lower surface of the leaf?
It's all over the leaf, and it's a white powdery coverage as well as on the flowers.
Okay. It's probably powdery mildew. And we had a relatively good season for that in certain areas. Powdery mildews tend to do better when we have somewhat dry conditions, but really high humidity. So it's oftentimes a pretty cosmetic disease. So I wouldn't worry too much about it unless you're seeing a lot of leaf browning associated with powdery mildews. We sometimes see that when we get powdery mildew on phlox or monardas. But I have not seen really severe powdery mildew on black-eyed Susan. So I would be patient with it. If you can thin things around that particular plant, open up the airflow, that oftentimes can reduce the humidity and you'll have fewer problems with powdery mildew. There are some fungicide options if you really want to go that route. We do have kind of a home remedy that we sometimes recommend that's based on some research out of Cornell University. It's a tablespoon and a half of baking soda that you can get off your kitchen shelf, and then 3 tablespoons of a lightweight horticultural oil. These are paraffin-based oils. And mix that in a gallon of water. But you need to apply this concoction before you see any symptoms. It's a preventative treatment. And that can sometimes give you some control of powdery mildews. It may simply be that we just had a great season for the disease. You may not want to treat next year, see what happens. It may be that the plant will look perfectly fine, because powdery mildews, their severity can vary from year to year.
Yeah. There we go. Wendy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Brian Huddleston, our guest today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We're zeroing in a bit on plant diseases here on the Ideas Network Garden Talk Show. Larry Mueller with my guest, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And it looks like we've got one open line yet at 1-800-642-1234. Email us your photos and or questions at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of our Ideas Network page, Jose emailed to sent a picture, a photo, and he wonders if his fur is diseased. The tips are losing needles, and that shows up pretty well here in the photo.
Yeah, my thought when I look at that is it might more likely be an insect problem. There may have been some larvae that were feeding on those needles. It could possibly be disease. What's interesting is that it looks like the needles near the tip and also the bud looks pretty good from what I can tell from the photos. So if it is a disease, it was probably very much environment related. So maybe a wet period last year when those needles got infected and then they've shed this year. But again, I would get out there early next season and watch for any larvae that might be associated with the last year's needles.
Yeah, I think you're right. We'll take another call. Oleg in Rice Lake, turning to you now. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hello. So I keep honeybees, and I was just thinking that, like, honeybees are really great vectors of transmitting pollen from plant to plant, and also there's quite a diverse array of molds that live in a beehive. So I was wondering, number one, are honeybees like a vector of plant disease transmission? Do they transmit disease from plant to plant? And also, are there any mold organisms that can kind of affect both? Like, can honeybees bring infections from their beehive onto a plant, or can they bring fungus from a plant that will then cause a problem in the beehive?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any fungal pathogens that are moved around by honeybees, but certainly there's a major bacterial pathogen that honeybees can move around, and that's the one that causes fire blight on apples and pears. When you have a tree that's infected with this organism, typically in the spring, there will be cracks in the bark, and then you get this oozy material that comes out, and it's a combination of plant sap and bacterial cells. And honeybees like to feed on that. It's quite nutritious for them, and in the process, they get the bacterium on their bodies. And then when they pollinate, they actually drop the bacterium into the nectaries on the flowers, and then it gets into the tips of the branches, and you get this branch tip dieback. And that can be a quite serious disease for apples, crab apples, pears, a lot of other different types of rosaceous plants as well. So that's an example of where a honeybee can cause a pathogen, but it's not fungal. If you look at the other way around, are there other insects that can move fungal pathogens around? Yes, indeed. And kind of the classic examples of two diseases where there are insects involved would be Dutch elm disease, where there are bark beetles that will move that particular fungus around. They tunnel in to lay their eggs. And if the tree happens to be infected, they can pick up spores and then move the pathogen from tree to tree. And then also oak wilt is another disease where the pathogen can be moved around by insects, in particular sap beetles, that will visit the trees, pick up the fungus, and then if you have an injured tree, they're attracted to the wound and they'll drop the fungus off as they visit the wound.
Did you mention molds? He asked about molds, and I meant...
Yeah, molds are basically a fungi, so certainly they could be moving spores of these organisms around. The question is whether or not they're actually disease-causing organisms, and again, I'm trying to dredge my memory if there are any fungal pathogens that are moved around by honeybees specifically. There may very well be, but there are none that pop into my mind as I'm thinking here. It's really that fire blight that's the classic example, and that's bacterial.
Oleg, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Sam in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Brian and Larry. I have a number of oak trees on my property, and I lost a handful to oak wilt. What should I expect a tree service to do when they remove the dead oak trees to prevent the spread to other trees in the area?
How close are those trees together?
Well, my first question is, do you know for sure that it's oak wilt? Have you had the trees actually tested for oak wilt?
Haven't had them tested, but they're red oaks and showed all the common signs of oak wilt. They died very quickly.
Okay. That's certainly a possibility, but I do caution folks that before you jump to the conclusion that you have oak wilt, that you get a test done, because there are other things that potentially can mimic oak wilt. One is two-line chestnut borer, which is an insect pest that will come in on trees that are under stress and can in very short order kill those trees. We do have another fungal pathogen that can cause issues, although it's usually a slower death. The pathogen is called armillaria, and it's a mushroom producer. It produces these really weird shoestring or root-like structures that grow out from an infected tree and kind of search for other root systems to infect. I would suggest probably getting a confirmatory test before you jump to that conclusion. Let's assume that it is oak wilt. If you have other red oaks, or so red oaks are the one of the oaks with kind of pointed lobed leaves. If you have other pointed lobed oaks in your yard, those trees could be root grafted. And so once the oak wilt fungus gets into one tree, it can actually move from tree to tree via root graft. Now, there are also what's called the white oak group of oaks, which have the rounded lobes. Those tend to pretty frequently root graft as well. You can occasionally get root grafts between the pointed lobed and the rounded lobed oaks as well. So you could get some transmission between both of those. Those are a little bit less common. But you could have trees that are already infected in your yard that just aren't showing symptoms right now. And Larry's question about how far away the trees are, that'll determine whether or not they're root grafted. So how large a property do you have and how close are the trees?
I'm on about 2 acres, and they're all fairly forest grown.
Okay.
So they're pretty close.
Yeah.
I'd assume that there'd be root grafts. I don't know if trenching around them would help, stump grinding.
Yeah, we do oftentimes recommend trenching, but another reason to make sure that you know that you have oak wilt, this armillaria disease that I mentioned, if you do that trenching to sever the root grafts and you're actually dealing with armillaria, you can make armillaria worse because that fungus oftentimes enters into trees through wounds and roots. So, like I said, I typically recommend testing before you do any sort of management just so you get things right.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck with that, Sam. Sorry to hear that story, but...
And in terms of what an arborist will do, if you've got a good arborist, we usually recommend a certified arborist.
Absolutely.
They know about my clinic on campus and can collect samples and get them in for testing. So that's one of the services that we provide.
There you go. Thanks again, Sam. Appreciate your call. And Diane in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. I have a climbing hydrangea that... in the spring, and it continues to have dark spots on it. I was wondering if you might know what that would be. This is the second year for it.
Yeah, it's probably a fungal leaf spot of some kind. It might be bacterial. In order to know, there's so many of these organisms that can cause leaf spots that without seeing a sample, it's hard to tell you exactly what it is. But typically, the management is pretty similar, whether it's bacterial or fungal, if it's a leaf spot. And that's good fall cleanup. So remove the leaves as they come off of that climbing hydrangea and then collect them up and get them out of your yard. And you can, if you are part of a municipal system where they come and pick up or you can drop it off at a site, I would do that. Sometimes if you're out in the country, if you have the option to burn the material, you can certainly do that, although that's not necessarily as environmentally friendly. If you're a good composter and do hot composting where you heat up the pile to 140 degrees Fahrenheit or higher and routinely turn it to stimulate that leaf tissue to rot away, that's another great way of getting rid of disease-causing organisms, and you can recycle and reuse the material in your yard. But getting rid of those infected leaves is the best thing you can do to limit reinfection the next spring. Now, if we get a lot of rain, like we had in the Madison area, even that may not help, because as diligent as you want to try to be to get rid of that leaf debris, you're not going to get all of it. So you'll have a source of at least some of the fungus. And if we get wet conditions, you know, all bets are off, quite frankly. Yeah. That's what we've seen with a lot of the tomato bites. You know, I give out instructions on how to try to control those. And if we get a year like this year, just forget it.
Doesn't matter.
But that would be my suggestion. These leaf diseases typically are not lethal. They just make the plants look a little bit ragged by the end of the season.
There you go, Diane. Thank you so much for calling. Deb emailed in a photo. She says she has 65 mature junipers, and judging by the photo, those are mature. Several are showing signs of dying foliage. Any idea what's happening?
Again, from the photos, what I'm seeing is a lot of localized brown branches on the shrubs, and that makes me wonder again about maybe some of these canker fungi that we talked about earlier, and you'd have to get in there and kind of prune out that material. If it was a larger area of the shrub, so a whole section that's dying back, again, it could be a canker organism working farther down in the shrub, but then I'd start worrying about root rot issues. And if this is occurring in an area where there was a lot of rain over the summer, there are root rot fungi or other organisms in the soil. They can infect the root system, destroy the roots, and then that interferes with water uptake and movement into the branches, and that'll cause a lot of dieback. The other thing that we saw, I don't think this is necessarily the case with this photo, but just to let folks know, we saw a lot of winter injury this past spring. So shrubs that came out of the winter that just turned brown right away. And we had kind of a funky winter with temperatures up and down, not a lot of snow cover, and all of those can contribute to evergreens, particularly things like yews and white cedar arborvitaes that can cause a lot of browning as we come out of the winter.
Kathy in River Falls, I think River Falls had some snow this last winter, but she has a question for us that also relates to pines. Kathy, hi.
Greetings, Brian and Paul, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a beautiful mogul pine in my front yard, and I noticed earlier this summer that some of the branches had some brown needles on them.
Mm-hmm.
And now I look at it, and the whole bottom third, or probably about fourth of the tree, seems to be brown, and I don't know what's going on with this tree. And I don't want to lose it.
Sure. Is it primarily the interior needles that are brown? Do you still have green needles at the tips, or is the entire branch brown?
Well, right now, the entire bottom of the tree is brown, not the top. Just the bottom of probably about a fourth of the tree, and it seems to be working its way up the branch.
Yep. So from on an individual branch, though, it's brown all the way to the tip? Is that correct?
No. It's just brown part way up.
Okay. So if you've got still on those needles or on those branches where you have some of those brown needles, you still have some green needles at the tips. My guess would be it's probably one of two fungal diseases. There's one called Dothy stroma, a needle blight. There's another one called brown spot, which one you have kind of depends on the pine host. Those are a bit difficult to control without using some sort of fungicide treatment. And you would need to treat next spring. And I would get probably some professional to come in and make the applications for you. You need to treat those new needles as they first emerge. That's when they're most apt to be infected. At this point, those green needles at the tips of the branches are probably already infected, and they will probably brown next year. So we do have a fact sheet on this particular disease that talks about what the treatments are like. And that's available at my clinic website. And if you're interested, it's pddc.wisc.edu. And I think Larry's going to post that up. And you go into the fact sheet section and look for Dothy stroma, D-O-T-H-I-S-T-R-O-M-A. So look for D-O-T, and you'll be able to find it.
There you go. Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. We have some open lines to get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And email us at ideas@wpr.org and send your questions via that route as well, and your photos. We've gotten a few already. Let's go to Jess in Elkhart Lake next. Hi, Jess.
Hi, good morning. I would like you to expand on the information about the new disease with the boxwood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called boxwood.
I have a lot of boxwood.
Yeah, so do a lot of other people, too. Yeah, you're up north, right? Is that correct?
Yes, exactly,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, my guess,
Green Bay.
You probably have a little bit of a reprieve for this because it's, at this point, has been relatively slow in moving from Illinois into Wisconsin. It's primarily been found in the southeast, so Kenosha, Racine area. But it will probably eventually spread elsewhere. That would be my guess. It is a fungal disease. It oftentimes starts off by infecting leaves. You'll get a relatively discreet kind of roundish brown spot, and then it will move and cause and kind of infect the entire leaf. They'll drop off. It will also infect the branches and then can girdle those and kill those off. And in extreme cases, it will kill the entire shrub. Unfortunately, like I mentioned earlier, here in Wisconsin, the varieties that tend to be cold hardy here in the state don't really have that much resistance to the disease. They have a little bit, but not a lot. The really resistant varieties tend to be ones that survive better farther south. So the options for the disease tend to be routine fungicide sprays if you want to keep the shrubs. My suggestion would be that's very costly. Takes a lot of time, and you're talking about having to do this every year and probably multiple applications long term. So my suggestion would be to look at options for replacing those shrubs long term and have those in place so that once the disease arrives and starts taking out your shrubs, you have something to replace them. And I hate to tell you that, but this is another situation where we have a shrub that's very popular, really has, in my mind, been overused. And so we're ending up with a disease that's coming in that's going to wipe out a fair number of the boxwoods that we have in the state. And we've seen this before. We saw this with elms, American elms, with Dutch elm disease, where it was totally overused. Beautiful trees at the time, but when you grow so many of the same thing, you end up running the risk of a disease coming in and wiping out everything or virtually everything.
And you're not seeing anything now, are you, Jess?
No, I just heard this, and I was totally alerted. I thought, what?
You know? Yeah, we should have a new fact sheet on this particular disease. I have a student who's doing his capstone in plant pathology with me this fall, and one of the fact sheets I'm forcing him to write is on boxwood blight. So hopefully by the spring we'll have a finished version, again, up on my website, or you can contact me, and I can mail you a copy in the mail. And I might as well give out my contact information.
Yeah, go ahead.
My email, if you'd like to email me, is Huddleson, H-U-D-E-L, S-O-N at wisc.edu, so W-I-S-C.edu. You're also welcome to call me, 608-262-2863. And I'm happy to talk to you on the phone if you want to send me photos. We don't charge for that, so you can send me photos. I may not be able to diagnose a lot from a photo, but that's certainly a place to start. And again, I just see this boxwood blight is getting progressively worse here in the state. It's not going to go away. And if you want to see some scary photos, just do a search on boxwood blight and put in a state on the East Coast, Maryland, for example, and you'll see these properties that are just loaded with boxwoods that are all basically dead from the disease.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
And I did a program at Albert Gardens this year, and I was shocked at how many boxwoods they have there, and they're just going to have to think about probably replacing some of those eventually as well.
There you go, Jess. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Don in Appleton a chance to join in. Don, hello to you.
Yes, sir. One of my hunting magazines said you can improve wildlife habitat if you fertilize your oak trees with 10-10-10 fertilizer in the late fall.
One pound
per inch.
No, I wouldn't fertilize. I usually don't recommend fertilizing trees and shrubs unless you have a soil test that says that they need to be fertilized. So, and definitely I would never fertilize late in the fall, because what you oftentimes do by fertilizing, particularly with nitrogen, is you keep the trees physiologically active so they don't harden off properly for the fall, and you can make them more prone to winter injury. So
I do not recommend that at all.
Quite frankly, and quite frankly, I don't necessarily think that you would probably need to fertilize oaks or other trees, period, particularly in a forested area.
Yeah, for sure. You might want to send a letter to the editor.
Yeah, ask them where they got that information, because that's a very, very odd recommendation in my mind.
Yeah, it is indeed. Don, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And please do send a note to the editor about that, because you don't want people doing that. For sure. Hi, sir. In Greenfield, it's your turn. Hi.
Hello. good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. It's Yasser, Y-A-S-S-E-R. My question, we have an indoor, and this is a two-part question, I hope, a lemon tree that it did bear fruit in the past, and we ate from those really delicious lemons. It's a small tree inside a pot. Last year, and meaning last fall and this fall, it did not bear any fruit. We took it outside in the summertime. It does look to have healthy leaves, but nothing coming out of it.
Did you, how old is the tree?
I think probably, I mean, we had it for around 5 years right now.
All right, so have you enlarged the pot at all?
Yeah, we did. I understand you have a lime tree. I remember before your daughter called it limey, which just didn't it. Okay, and we put it in a bigger pot. At one point, it did have, and this is before it bloomed last time, it did have what it looks like, some kind of residue on the leaves, and we trimmed it down totally, and it grew back, and as I said, it looks like healthy leaves, nothing, no blooming whatsoever. Yeah.
Were you fertilizing it at all?
I did probably a month and a half ago, one of those like miracle fertilizer, and I used actually a little bit less than the recommended amount.
Oh, that's probably good. Yeah. Less fertilizer is probably maybe better in your circumstance. If it's really fertile, it's possible that's why it's not producing fruit.
Yeah, you get leaves instead of flowers. And also, I'm wondering if the pruning, you pruned off the buds, that may have pruned off the flower buds.
Well, I mean, we're trying to get rid of whatever that was infecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It grew more new branches and new leaves and so forth. So,
I would, and you did that this past year. So,
right.
I would hold on. It's good and healthy. Get it inside. Put it on some grow lights, maybe, if you can. That's what I do with limey. And I'm willing to bet that you're going to get some flowers, or you're going to get some lemons again. It may just have take a year, given on the pruning you had to do.
Question: I have a pomegranate, which, again, in the past, it did bloom. And you got those little tiny, if that's the right term, pomegranates into it, and then they all fall down. And right now it's losing all its leaves. And this is, we brought it in again a couple of weeks ago because it started getting a little bit colder at night. And right now it's just hardly any leaves on it.
Yeah, that's probably a function of light. When you bring it into the house, you're losing a lot of light, and it's very common for plants to lose their foliage for a while. Now, this pomegranate may come back, but you need to give it as much light as you possibly can. I wouldn't worry too much about it, frankly. I think, and maybe I'm wrong. Brian, do you have anything?
Yeah, oftentimes, I'm not that familiar with pomegranate, but again, I've heard of other types of plants where they've been grown outdoors and then you bring them in, and because of the change of environment, they tend to shed leaves. And it's just a matter of being a patient until they releaf.
Yeah, there you go. So hang on to it, yes, sir. And hopefully you're going to get some lemons, and hopefully your pomegranate plant is going to come back. Thank you very much for calling. Our guest today, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison within the Department of Plant Pathology. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic Always fun to have him come by, and certainly great to have you listening in. And if you have a plant disease question, a plant question, I hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo, go ahead and email us that photo at ideas@wpr.org. Zach in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Zach.
Hey, guys. I'm considering using grafting tomatoes next year, so using rootstock that is resistant to certain diseases. And I wonder if you think that that would help in our climate. And additionally, if I grew them in a greenhouse or at least covered from the rain, if you also think that that would help my chances at preventing diseases.
Yeah, what sort of diseases are you seeing on your tomatoes? Is it primarily the foliar diseases? Are you seeing wilt diseases where the entire plant dies, wilts and dies?
I've seen foliar, I mean, like right now, I actually just pulled out my tomato plants, and when I was pulling them out, like you could see the inside of the primary stem of the plant was like rotted.
Okay.
And earlier in the year, actually, like back in like June, early July, I had a, I can't remember the name of the disease, but it was the fruit itself was what was showing.
Okay.
The problem. And then, so I think it's a mixture of blight and like maybe two other diseases. Yeah.
You might be able to get some benefits. The grafted tomatoes, the rootstocks typically, from what I understand, have resistance to some of the, what we call vascular wilt diseases. These typically are fungal. In tomatoes, Verticillium and Fusarium are the two most common pathogens involved. These are ones that infect through the roots typically and then block the water conducting tissue, and they cause the plants to wilt and die. So if you've had a history of those sorts of diseases in your garden, the grafted varieties would probably provide you with some benefit. I also talked to our vegetable pathologist, Amanda Gevins, about whether or not you could get any benefit for some of the foliar diseases. And she said actually there was some empirical evidence. So people have actually observed that, yes, with some of these grafted tomatoes, you can get lower levels of some of the fungal diseases. Although, again, with the weather environment that we had this year in Madison, where it was so wet, I don't think those grafted tomatoes probably would have done that much better than non-grafted varieties. It doesn't sound like you're dealing, though, with any of the vascular wilt diseases from what you've described. If you're going to put those plants in a hoop house or a greenhouse where they don't have a lot of exposure to the fungal spores that can cause these leaf diseases, you'll probably get some benefit from that. And then again, I don't know whether it'll be beneficial in terms of the cost of the grafted varieties for you to purchase those. But again, I certainly, what I would suggest that you do is try some of them. Don't go whole hog and just invest in all of these grafted varieties and kind of compare them with some of your other favorite varieties and see how they perform relative to one another. And then next year, the following year, you can kind of base a decision about whether you want to spend the money or not on those.
That makes good sense.
The stem rot that you're seeing, that could be possibly a bacterial disease. We have a disease called bacterial canker. Oftentimes, that particular pathogen is brought in on seed. So it's a seed-borne pathogen, and we have seen an increase in that recently. So buying high-quality seed, if you're growing the plants from seed, is always something very, very important. If you have a seed source that's of kind of questionable quality and you're worried about bringing things in on the seed, we do have a fact sheet called Hot Water Seed Treatments for Disease Management. So you can actually heat the seed in hot water and you can actually kill off these disease-causing organisms that are on or in the seed. And you might want to check that out at my website as well.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Zach, thanks. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Larry in Menominee, your turn now. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had trouble with fire blight in my apples for the last few years, and we've got about 20 trees. And regardless of the variety, it seems to be a problem. Does it affect the fruit and cause them to mummify on a year like this year?
If the entire branch is dying back and it had fruit on it and it was due to fire blight, yes, those fruits could shrivel up just because they're not getting any water from the death of the branch. Now, are you seeing these shriveled fruits on branches where the leaves are still green?
That is correct. And they'll, any anyone that touches them, they if they're in a group together, they seem like they spread from apple to apple, but they don't drop off. And this fall when I was picking apples, and I noticed them during the year, they seemed like they would spread from branch to branch, and that was it.
Yeah, the leaves are still green, though. Is that correct?
Yes, they're, they're somewhat, on some of the trees, they're somewhat epinastic kind of at the tip.
Okay. Yeah, then I doubt whether what you're seeing in the fruits is fire blight. There are some fungal pathogens that can infect the fruit and possibly could cause them to mummify. Did you see kind of a buff-colored fuzzy material or on the surface of those fruits? Okay, because there is a disease, it's more common on plums and cherries and peaches called brown rot that will go to apples, and that one will cause them to mummify, but it could be another fungal disease. I'd have to see some apples in the clinic to give you a better sense of what's going on. There might also be some insect component to that as well. We do see a lot of insects laying eggs in fruits, causing kind of growth distortions, and sometimes those areas where they lay the eggs, they create a wound and fungi can get in there and cause some additional damage.
There you go. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate the call. Mark in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I have an ash tree in my yard, and I noticed this summer probably a quarter to a third of it never really got good leaves on it.
Okay.
And then there's a couple of spots on the trunk where the bark, if I took a, you know, like a screwdriver or a pocket knife, I could just chunk the bark off. It came off really, really easy, but not all the way around the tree, just like probably a 10-inch circle on one side and a smaller spot on the other side of the tree.
Yeah, when you popped off that bark, did you see any trails underneath the bark?
No, I actually was kind of looking for that. I didn't see any.
Because I'd be a little concerned about emerald ash borer, which is an insect pest that can cause some real serious problems on ash. Now, when you saw the leaf thinning, did you see any branches that were totally dead, or was just kind of a general thinning across the tree?
Dead, and it's only on a part of the tree. It's not like the whole tree is thinner. It's like the front half of the tree, I'll call it, looks really healthy.
Okay.
But, you know, this other spot is really bare.
Okay, and the branches that are dying, are they kind of under where you saw the loose bark or above where you saw the loose bark?
No, actually, it's opposite. The biggest spot of loose bark is on the good side of the tree, and the smallest spot of the loose bark is on the bad side of the tree.
Okay. There may be multiple things that are going on, quite frankly, because the loose bark indicates to me that there was probably some sort of injury, and that could be something like winter injury. We sometimes get, particularly on kind of on the south side of trees, we'll get some damage over the wintertime, and that can eventually lead to loose bark. Oftentimes that occurs on trees that are under stress, and that can be from planting issues if they were planted too deeply. And if you're seeing branch dieback kind of in a section on one side of the tree, then I also worry about a fungal disease called verticillium wilt. And I mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
It's a fungal disease. The fungus is found in the soil, infects the roots, and then gets into the water conducting tissue and blocks it off. That's a disease. Again, if you see it, I recommend getting a sample into my lab for testing, because if you actually have that disease, it really limits what you can use as a replacement tree. There are a lot of trees and shrubs that are susceptible to that particular fungus. Mm-hmm. So those are some possibilities. Without seeing a sample, I can't say too much more than that.
Mark, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Andy emailed, he lives in Madison, has a mature sour cherry tree, and he sent us a photo of a leaf. In August, the leaves turned yellow with brown spots, and we're seeing that in our email. And then they dropped off completely. Yeah. Last year, the same thing happened, so he thinned the branches to improve air circulation, vacuumed up the leaves. Problem still seems to be there. Any ideas?
My thought is probably cherry leaf spot, which is a fungal disease. And that one, if that's truly what you're dealing with, again, I hate to make a recommendation without knowing for sure that it's the actual disease, because I can lead you astray if I do this. But let's assume that it is cherry leaf spot. You'd have to go with fungicide sprays. And early on, you need to get those on early as the trees are beginning to leaf out before the fungus is actually able to infect, because the sprays are protective sorts of materials that are preventing infection. They will not cure existing infections. And a lot of the fruit tree sprays, if they're labeled for use on cherries, will have a fungicide in them that will be effective for controlling that particular disease. But my recommendation would be, if you really want to know, get a sample in for us to diagnose.
And Kathy in Madison, do you have a quick question for us?
You bet. I have three kinds of plums. The wild plums never bore fruit. I bought a pipestone. It had a few fruits. So then I bought a Tomei. that had about tons of fruit, but or this year, it was the second year of that I had planted it, and all the fruits fell off.
Yeah.
And I have lots of walnuts in the area, but why would, there was no evidence of any disease of any sort, but I just wondered why the plums would fall off, or perhaps they were stolen green by critters.
Yeah, probably not all of them.
There are several things that can cause fruits not to develop and to drop off. Sometimes it's poor pollination. That certainly could be one factor. Sometimes if insects get in there and begin laying eggs, that can be an issue. There are some fungal diseases as well. Brown rot is the big one, but usually you'd see kind of a buff, fuzzy growth on the surface of those fruits if that's the problem.
Yeah, anything to do?
With brown rot, it's really clean up the fruits that have fallen to the ground. You may have to watch for some branch dieback because that fungus can kill branch tips. Prune those out, thin the tree to get better airflow. And then if you continue to have issues with brown rot, then again, you're down to using fungicide sprays and, again, preventative to manage the disease.
And you'd be pruning in the cold of winter?
I would typically recommend winter pruning for most things because that's when pathogens aren't active.
Kathy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Brian Huddleston, our guest today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Always great to have him with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Always great to have him come by. We talk plant diseases and all kinds of plant issues with him. And if you have a question for him, join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Brian, you've got a Facebook page, you've got a Twitter account.
Yeah.
Talk about those a little bit before we go to Sue in Appleton.
Yeah, I have a Twitter account if you're interested in following me. It's at UWPDDC, and then also a Facebook page. You could just search on Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic or at UWPDDC. You'll get to my Facebook page as well. I tend to limit how much I tweet and post on Facebook because I want it to be as educational as possible. So I'm not going to be telling you when I'm out in the garden or using the men's room or anything of that sort. But I do post regularly. I do a weekly summary of the diseases I've seen in the clinic called the Wisconsin Disease Almanac when that goes up on my website. I post about that. Also, I have a monthly web article that I put up on my website whenever that comes out. This month's is Dr. Death's Halloween. So you can go and read about that. And then when we have newer updated fact sheets, I will post about those. And then sometimes during the summer, I see really cool diseases. I'll take some photos and post a little of information about that. I have to say, if you want to get a Twitter account, visit the NPR website and do a search on Brian Unger and Twitter. He was their in-house humorist for a while, and he did the most incredible hysterical piece on Twitter that I've ever heard. And I actually downloaded that so I could have a copy of it, and it makes me laugh every time I'm feeling down a little bit. I'll listen to that.
And so yours is at?
At UWPDDC.
There we go. Now we will turn to Sue in Appleton. Sue, hello.
Hello, Larry and Brian. Thanks for being available to us.
Sure.
I have a shagbark hickory tree, and all this summer, well, since the summer started, it's had like 1/4-inch brown spots in between the leaves, and the leaves looked a little bit chlorotic, and it has dropped the leaves early.
Okay.
I have no clue what's going on. My other ones are good.
Okay. It could be a fungal leaf spot of some kind, and sometimes trees will vary in terms of their susceptibility. Their plants are kind of like people. Well, some of us get more diseases than others, and trees can be the same way. If it is a leaf spot of some kind, good fall cleanup is what I normally recommend. And then the other thing you might want to consider would be doing a soil nutrient test and see whether or not there may be some fertility issues associated with that particular tree that you need to deal with. And that can be done through our UW Soil Analysis Lab, which is up in Marshfield, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's necessarily probably lethal, but you do some fall cleanup this year and get rid of those leaves.
Good luck. Thank you so much, Sue, for calling. Kathy in Cedarburg, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Brian.
Hi there.
I have a question about, I guess a similar question as the last caller about leaf blot on chestnut trees. I have a beautiful tree. It's an heirloom tree. It came from a family farm that was established in 1848.
Mm-hmm.
And mine now is a 15-foot tall tree. It grows beautifully in the springtime. They get beautiful leaves, but suddenly they start getting blotches on them and fall to the ground.
Yes.
First tree in the neighborhood to lose its leaves.
Okay.
And I have read that it's a fungal thing and to clean up the leaves, which I did this year.
Mm-hmm.
But is there anything else I can do?
Yes.
I want to make sure this tree survives.
Is this a true chestnut, American chestnut, or is this a horse chestnut?
Horse chestnut.
Yeah, then it's probably a disease called Guinardia leaf blotch. That's very common on horse chestnuts. Trees, again, will vary in terms of their susceptibility, but it can be, particularly in really wet years, quite severe and can cause defoliation. My suggestion would be to try the fall cleanup, see if you get good success with that. If you have several years where it's doing this, then you might want to consider talking to a certified arborist who could do fungicide treatments to treat the tree. My main concern is that if you get defoliation year after year after year, you can stress the tree so that it becomes more susceptible to other diseases. I wouldn't expect this disease to kill the tree, but it can stress things. So, but I have also seen horse chestnuts that defoliate many years in a row with very little effects. So I would not be overly concerned. I just kind of monitor it at this point. And again, make sure you do the good fall cleanup.
Good luck. Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it. Heather emailed to say her mature honey locust tree has produced pods very prolifically over the years, and this year not one single pod. She noticed that other trees in her West Madison neighborhood don't have any either.
Mm-hmm.
What's the issue here, maybe?
I'm wondering if there was a lot of rain when the trees were flowering. Sometimes we have issues not only with things like honey locust, but a lot of flowering trees that if we get a lot of rain when pollination is occurring, they don't pollinate for one reason or another. I don't know exactly how honey locusts are pollinated, whether it's wind pollinated or insect pollinated. But either way, you could have potential issues. With flowering plants where bees are involved, they don't like to be out when it's wet, so they won't pollinate, and oftentimes the rain will actually beat the petals off of the flowers so that they aren't attractive to the bees anymore. With wind-pollinated trees, I would also expect some problems if there's a lot of rain because the pollen will just wash away rather than getting blown around. So that may be what's going on. As long as the trees look healthy otherwise with good foliage, then I wouldn't be overly concerned.
Jean in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Larry. I have a question on an elderberry.
Okay.
About a two or three-year-old bush. It's the golden one. It's about 5 feet wide, 5 feet high, beautiful. All of a sudden, in July, everything died off of it. All that was left were the branches. It was all gnarly looking, and couple weeks ago it started shooting again. Any ideas what could have affected it?
Is it shooting up sprouts from the base, or is it just releafing on those branches that were...
It's releafing from the branches.
My suspicion is there was some sort of foliar disease that got established on that shrub. And it's very common for trees and shrubs to, if the disease is severe, to shed the leaves. And then they do have auxiliary buds that can sprout if there's enough time in the growing season to produce another set of leaves. So that would be my guess, is that there was a disease that infected the old leaves, they just fell off, and now the tree is responding as it typically would by putting out some new leaves. So again, I wouldn't be overly concerned about what's going on. And we had a very, very wet year. So I would say at least, did you have a lot of wet weather up in Green Bay?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and that would be a typical sort of problem. We had a lot of leaf diseases wherever it was wet in the state, so damn. I'm not surprised by what you're describing.
Here you go, Gene. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Orange County, California next. Talk with Cynthia. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling regarding an apple tree, which seems to be a theme today. I have an Ein Schemmer. It's year three. Year one was good. Year two, I got fire blight, and so I contacted the University of California Master Gardeners. They explained how to cut deeply to remove the fire blight, and I must have been successful because I didn't have that this year. This year, I had lots of fruit set, but almost every single apple on the end of the apple had a black spot on it, and some of the apples were kind of deformed in shape.
Okay.
And I don't know how it all turned out because the blue jays took it all.
Yeah.
So it was the bottom surface of the fruit that had the black kind of rotted area? Was it kind of rotted?
Yes.
Yeah. I suspect the distortions that you're seeing are probably insect-related, most commonly when we see these weird warped-looking apples or pears, it's because there are insects in there laying eggs, and that kills a little bit of localized tissue, and then as the fruits grow, they grow very weirdly. The bottom of the fruit, if it's rotting like that, I'd actually be interested to see if somebody did a fertility test on those fruits, whether they were short on calcium. We get a phenomenon on tomatoes very commonly here in Wisconsin called blossom end rot, where the fruits don't have enough calcium and then it causes the bottom of the fruit to rot away. And that occasionally can occur on other types of fruits, and including things like apples and pears. I wouldn't also rule out, however, there being some insect damage with kind of a secondary invasion by some sort of fungus or bacterium that's causing some decay in the fruits. But those are a few options. I would definitely contact your master gardener group again or your diagnostic clinic in California and see if they can steer you towards a lab that can do some fertility testing for you. And also if you get those fruits again, where you can send in some of the fruits for them to take a look and really give you a formal diagnosis. If you're interested in finding your local lab, if you go to the website npdn.org, that's the website for the National Plant Diagnostic Network. And you'll get a map of the United States. Just click on California, and it'll give you local information on your diagnostic lab. All of the land-grant university diagnostic labs, both disease and insect labs in the country, are networked in this National Plant Diagnostic Network.
So that was NPDN.
That's correct.
.org.
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
Cynthia, I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. And Dan in Waukesha up next. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Can you tell me a little bit about these tar spots I'm getting on my maple trees?
Yeah.
Up about them.
That's a fungal disease. Do you know what kind of maple you have?
I don't know. It was Wisconsin.
Okay. Yeah, there are a couple of different tar spot diseases. We have two different fungi that tend to be involved. It's a localized infection on the leaf. You get this very black, tarry sort of spot that occurs. And if you are dealing with a silver maple, we have a native species of the fungus that causes a very, very solid spot that if you look in the center, it looks like somebody left a thumbprint. And it's along those ridges where the fungus produces its spores in the leaf litter in the spring. And then if you have a Norway maple, which is where we're seeing a lot of the disease anymore, the disease starts out as a whole bunch of little tiny black tarry spots that eventually kind of merge together as the disease progresses over the course of the growing season, over the course of the summer. And that's caused by actually an introduced fungus from Europe. So it kind of followed Norway across the Atlantic Ocean. Both of the diseases are pretty much cosmetic. My normal recommendation is good fall cleanup. Get rid of those leaves that come off the tree. Get rid of the source of the spores that are likely to reinfect the tree next year. So the diseases that you could possibly have, this is one not to sweat too much about.
Yeah. I think I've mentioned this before on the show, but every single maple tree in my neighborhood has.
Interestingly, I didn't see as much of the disease as I really expected to see this year based on the amount of rain that we have. I'm not quite sure exactly what happened. Maybe the rain timing just wasn't quite right, but I was expecting a lot more.
Well, we have Terry in Robert's email to ask if you can explain what tomato blight is and why it's so hard to grow tomatoes which used to be so easy to grow.
There are several different fungal pathogens that can cause tomato blights. The two common diseases that we see causing kind of a bottom-up defoliation of the plants, one's called Septoria leaf spot, which we tend to see in my neck of the woods down here in the Madison area in southern Wisconsin. If you're farther north in the area where they grow a lot of potatoes, you could be seeing early blight.
Yeah.
So a slightly different fungus that causes that disease. The reason you see more of that a little farther north is because that particular fungus will infect both tomatoes and potatoes. So you've got a ready source of that fungus, say in the Stevens Point area where they have a lot of potato production. But they both infect the lower leaves where it's a little wetter, and then they'll work their way up, defoliate the plants, and usually leave some fruit that are unblemished, but usually get a reduction in yield, and also the fruits tend to be a little bit smaller. In terms of why we're seeing more of it, I think more people are probably growing tomatoes, so there are more of these fungi out and about in the environment, and so it's hard to get away from them. We've also had some relatively wet growing seasons recently in some areas of the state, and that will certainly make these diseases more prevalent. The wetter the plants are for a longer period of time, the more likely these fungi are going to cause problems. And our typical recommendations are good fall cleanup, rotation, so move your tomatoes to a different area in your garden next year. That's not a great management strategy for these diseases because the spores tend to blow around a lot, but we always recommend rotation just to prevent a wide range of other diseases. You can certainly select resistant varieties, although sometimes the flavor of the fruit of those resistant varieties is not that great. The big thing culturally is good plant spacing, so space your plants far apart.
Too close together.
My recommendation is when you have full-size plants, you don't want any of the foliage to overlap. You want good airflow so that if the leaves get wet, they dry quickly. And then judicious pruning. Prune off some of those lower leaves, cut out the suckers to open up the canopy and allow better airflow. That'll promote more rapid drying as well. And then mulch underneath the plants. I would also mulch over the area where you had tomatoes and potatoes last year because you're just trying to block any spores that are being produced and little bits of old debris in the soil from getting into the air to blow around. And then if you're absolutely desperate, there are fungicide treatments. But at that point, if you think you need to do that, my suggestion is go to your local farmer's market and buy some tomatoes.
I grow all my tomatoes in straw bales, so.
Mm-hmm. And that can be successful, but I would not reuse the straw bales more than 1 year because that can be a source. If you get those old leaves, you may get a little of the disease that hangs out in the straw. Then if you replant, your new plants are going to get infected.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234. We might have time for you. Harold in Burnhamwood up next. Harold, hi.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I got to listen to part of the program. Regarding the people that have just few apple trees, I got the idea from a gentleman connected with the UW who 20 years ago was doing grafting things and said, those of you who just want a few apples, try bagging your apples. And when I get time, I've been doing it, and I've had a fair amount of really good success. Yeah. And I'm just wondering if there's any bit more to it than what I'm doing. I'm just using sandwich bags, cutting off the bottom two corners and stapling it on. With every year I get, whether it's a box of 50 bags or 100, I get some really nice apples.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm betting the person you got this from was Bob Tomish because he did grafting stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yeah, he's long gone, unfortunately, but he did a lot of great work with apples and other types of fruit trees. And yeah, I think bagging can be very, very useful. I think probably with plastic bags, it'd be useful for disease control, but I think the biggest impact is probably for insect control, quite frankly. You have to be a little bit careful. If you've got a plastic bag, you could get a lot of moisture trapped in there, and then you could potentially, if you do get pathogens in there, they could go really wild. But if you're having good success doing that, my suggestion is keep on doing it. I can tell you everything under the sun that I think will work. Nothing is really better than success in hand. So if you're doing it and it works for you, continue to do it.
Miss Bob Tomish, he was a regular guest on this program and a great guy.
Yeah, I knew him for years.
Thanks, Harold. Dennis in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Okay, I just heard the advice not to reuse straw bales.
Yes.
Yes.
So my question is, what should we do with the straw bales after we use them for a year?
Can you compost?
Okay, so that's not going to cause any transference?
No, what I would do, if you do good hot composting where you're heating up the pile and turning it regularly to get that straw to decay, from a disease standpoint, I wouldn't expect anything that would likely be in there from typical vegetable gardening to cause a problem if you reuse that material, as long as it's completely composted.
And I didn't see, if I don't see any disease in the plants that I've used, this year, what I did was I put all of the straw in a big pile, and then I got my seed potatoes, and I threw the seed potatoes, just threw them in the pile, and I've got potatoes.
Yeah. Yeah, the real issue is how much disease you have and what's growing in there. And that's the same thing for whenever you're growing in a regular garden setting as well. If you don't have a lot of disease in your plants, you don't have anything to carry over. But in general, we recommend kind of recycling this material if you can by composting.
Jessica in Viroqua, thank you for calling.
Hi there. I have a question. I had a pagoda dogwood tree this past spring, and I just loved it. And we had recently done put a new driveway in. It was asphalt. And about 2 years later, this past spring, I noticed that parts of the tree were like this beautiful gold.
Yeah.
But then it, I forget the name of the blight or the disease that it had.
Called golden canker.
That's right. A beautiful golden canker took out my tree.
Yeah.
And it didn't leaf out, and I basically just cut the tree down. I tried to do different remedies with different soaps and other things, but that was just kind of a joke, I think.
Yeah.
And now I have some other pagoda dogwoods that are kind of part of this lineage that are like 3 feet tall, and they're in that same area, and I'm wondering if I should try to like cross my fingers or what I should do.
Yeah, we usually see a lot of golden canker and pagoda dogwood when the trees are under a lot of stress. So if they're planted in an open area rather than in shade, which is their natural habitat, if they're drought stressed, probably the construction of your driveway stressed the trees as well. That will predispose them to getting infected by this fungus that causes, again, a very beautiful looking disease, but it's not very good for your tree. If these other dogwoods are in a shaded environment, you're giving them good water, you're mulching them properly, then I would say you probably won't have a lot of problems. I would simply monitor. If you can catch the golden canker early enough, you can actually prune it out, prune down about 4 inches below where you see that gold color, and then disinfest your tools. 70% alcohol for 30 seconds is a good way to do that as a dip.
There you go. Thank you so much. I want to go back to that Twitter account. You were talking about your Halloween. You've got a post.
Dr. Death's Halloween is, and I put up my three favorite creepy crawly diseases. So there's bacterial soft rot, our malaria root disease, and common smut of corn. So you can read a little bit on that if you'd like to.
Corn smut. You can eat that.
If you catch it early enough, if you let it sporulate, it's not very tasty at all. But you may have heard of it as huitlacoche, which is a very common delicacy, particularly in Mexican cooking.
And that account, again, to get to that.
At UWPDDC.
Brian, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with
us today.
Thanks
for having me again.
Yeah,
and putting up with me as well.
we'll visit with Dr. Death again. In the meantime, go to his account at UWPDDC and take a look at his Halloween diseases. All right, there we go. Oh, always great. Always fun to have him on, even though we have to talk about death a lot when he's on. He does a great job. Monday at this time, we'll be talking about the latest research on plantar fasciitis with our regular physical therapy guest, so I hope you can join us for that. That begins at 11 o'clock, and it'll go right until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, hey, thanks for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mehler.